Hey, it's time for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. And I'm Dr. Lisa, you know, the self-proclaimed psychotherapist. Ha, ha, ha. Hey, how you doing? Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for listening to Radio Free Brooklyn, the greatest station in the Western Hemisphere. Anyway, you know what? I want to tell you guys something. This is going to be my last show, live show for the summer, and then I'm going to do best ofs all summer. So be ready for that, okay? Because I'm taking the summer off. I am going to Togo, Africa. I am going to perform. I'm going to do a performance pretending I'm a grandma in a performance festival. I'm not kidding. Isn't that crazy? And then I booked a couple of weeks by myself. Without my husband, like where I don't have to deal with the other people in June, July, and shit like that. So I'll be thinking about you, okay? I'll be thinking about you. And also, you're getting like the best of my catalog, which is like 350 episodes, all right? You should be happy about it. You get a break from me. Anyway, like I said, thanks for listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. Please check us out online, radiofreebrooklyn.org. We are a 501c. We do so many great things for the community, and it's a really worthwhile organization to donate to. We're also promoting cancer screening for Men's Health Month. And I think that's really important because men don't get enough attention about their health. But even so, I'm being cynical, but even so, I think, you guys are like, I'm tough. You guys are humans. Okay. That body is fallible. I'm sorry. Maybe you don't think you're fallible, but that body is just a regular old body, no matter what you think about it. So, time for some free, if you're over 45, you can get a free cancer screening and go to NY Cancer Screening. All right, there you go. So I'm going to tell you about my guest who I have on today. I'm the most amazing guest. She is like talented in every single way. She's hard to categorize, but I'm going to say comedy, design, painting. I'll tell you, let me read a little of the bio and see if we can get through it. Okay, let's get a little through the bio. She's an author, designer, painter, and educator whose impressive body of work encapsulates her vivacious, outspoken, and colorful personality. I will vouch for that, okay? Her most recent book, How to Make Mistakes on Purpose, was the subject of a TED Talk, which was fabulous. I will make a post about that. And she has this touring workshop of the same name. And we're going to talk about that in a second. She gave me the book. It's right. So, but before we, I want to talk about that. But I also just want you to know, she also wrote four books. This woman's amazing. This woman is amazing. And then, like, she's done illustration, product design, all this stuff. For The Atlantic, Bloomingdale's, Fiorucci, IKEA, Wall Street Journal, Whitney Museum. And I'm only reading a small portion because we only have an hour. She also designed a typeface. She's taught graphic design. She's won all these awards. She was nominated for an Emmy. Okay, are you impressed already? Okay. And she's on my show. Can you get over it? So, hi, Lori.
Hello.
Can you get a little closer? Get a little closer to the mic.
How's
the
that?
Mic likes,
is that better?
The mic likes you. It wants
better?
You to get close.
Okay.
Yeah. So, Lori, did I cover it?
I would say so.
You think so? There's a lot there.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk to you about this book and your workshop because that's really what your life is focused on right now. And let me just read the quote on the cover, okay, guys? Guys, listen to this. This is a quote. Lori's voice is fresh, sounding funny, and completely her own. David Sedaris. Okay. So David Sedaris wrote the quote. You and David Sedaris must know each other, right? You have similar sensibilities.
Yes, I'd say we're friends. Yeah.
That does not surprise me one little bit. So tell us about the workshops and the book and that whole aspect of what you're doing.
Okay. Well, I've been doing the workshops for 30-something years. I started out doing it when I was teaching in different art schools. One of them was Camberwell in London. And I was sort of feeling like we were getting into a pattern. So I just had them like draw really, 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 really fast, like a factory. Because what happens is when people were getting, and that was in the 90s, you know, and every minute we've had digital technology since it started, you know, like since I, when did I get my first Mac? Like 89 or somewhere in there, 88. And, you forget that it affects everything that you do, and computers don't make mistakes. And I think what's happened over the years is that now there's three generations, really, of people that have grown up with digital technology, and we need basically a kick in the pants or some kind of sabotage to bring back, you could call it mistakes or accident or chance or serendipity. That's what my workshops are about, is to sabotage the everyday digital perfect problem-solving world that we live in and bring in something random. It's really about the random and how that can help you. It's super practical.
Well, what I love about your approach is that it's really great for like everybody. You're really talking about some very basic cognitive skills, aren't you? Like where you're kind of like writing by hand as opposed to writing on a computer, right? It's like just in, you're talking about getting in touch with your innate creativity and instincts.
Well, that's part of it. But I think that the main reason that the workshops are so fun and popular is that rather than trying to focus on making one good thing, you know, I always talk about the guy that invented Velcro, right?
Mm-hmm.
He went walking in the mm-hmm. woods and he got these little sticky plants, these burrs stuck on his pants, and he said, oh, and then he was playing with them and mm-hmm. then said, oh, you know, look at this. What can this do? And he saw they stuck together and then he invented Velcro. But what he didn't do was sit in a perfect white laboratory and say, you know, I'm going to be creative now. And what the world needs is a new way to stick stuff together. And I'm going to be creative and invent that now. No. Something natural happened, something
natural.
Chaotic.
Natural.
And I want to bring that back. So it's
right.
really about a way of thinking.
Right.
And what I like is that I'm not against digital anything. I use it every second like we all do, and I'm going to keep using it. And people that say we should go back to some analog world, they're living in a dream world. It's not going to happen. So you have to accept it. But what I like is to mix it up, mm-hmm. to bring the digital and the mm-hmm. analog world of mistakes and sabotage and surprise and chaos mm-hmm. together and mm-hmm. mush them together, because I think that's where exciting things happen mm-hmm. when you have something blobby and organic mm-hmm. and crazy with something very strict and geometric and logical, and you smash them together. That's what I like to do.
And the thing is, it's the thing about it is it works for so many different kinds of groups, right? Because you've traveled all over the world to do this, and you've done it in corporate environments. Tell us a little bit about the different environments. And also, I know you've gotten letters and stuff. I want to hear a little bit about the feedback.
Yeah, I mean, I've gotten great responses from all kinds of different people. I mean, I've done it for like 200 people. I did it for a herd of elk in Canada. I did it for... I did it for the Prince of Sweden.
Wow.
The elk just showed up at one of my workshops in Banff, Alberta, Canada.
Oh, my God.
I'm actually going back to Vancouver in a few days to teach there. But they just showed up. It was incredible. And some of that I put on a YouTube video. I have a lot of mistakes workshop videos on YouTube. But then, you know, the Prince of Sweden one was, there was this, I taught at RISD, where I went to school, Rhode Island School of Design. And this is many years ago, and there was a Swedish guy in the class. And because I've been living in Sweden on and off for many years, and I speak Swedish, we were chatting in Swedish, and he was very nice, very shy, very good looking, with long dark hair. And then that was that. And then a few months later, I was in Sweden talking to the head of the art school in Stockholm, and he said, you know, the prince is going to RISD. I said, really? And I said, well, there was a Swedish guy in my class. And he said, well, was that? I said, I don't know. His name was Kalle, and Kalle is like Charlie in Swedish. And the name, it's a nickname for Prince Carl Philip. And I was still wasn't sure it was him, but then I went to the train station or all these postcards, and it was him, but he was incognito at RISD. And so, yeah. So now I'm a kungliga hövleverantör, which is a way of saying by appointment to the royal family.
Oh, nice. I would like to.
Yeah, that's my big.
But you really like people. You can work with any kind of group, right?
Yeah, well,
like you're valuable
like
to
Johnson,
any.
Johnson and Johnson did it, and they did it on Zoom right in the middle of the pandemic. And I thought it was the first time I'd done it on Zoom, and I thought it would be boring, but it wasn't. It was really fun.
Well, you're
anyway.
Funny.
Well, you know, we had a good time.
She used to do comedy.
Oh, yeah.
Well, no, I mean, seriously. Okay, go ahead.
Anyway, I've done it for a lot of people that have nothing to do with art and design. My favorite group, in fact, is a bunch of people. They could be business people. They could be in sales, in financial world, anything. And, you know, or marketing, all that. And they show up and they have no idea what's going to happen except that, you know, somebody says, oh, at, you know, 1 o'clock, there's a workshop called How to Make Mistakes on Purpose. And then they come into the room and they have no idea what's going to happen. And I always make everybody that takes the workshop swear, you know what omerta is?
No.
It's the mafia code of silence.
Ah.
So I make everybody swear that they don't tell anybody the big secret, and I won't tell you either. But something happens in that room, and it's fun to have a secret, I think.
Yeah.
So that you can tell people later, oh, it was a great workshop, I loved it, you should do it. Or you can say it was totally worthless, it stank, Lori's an idiot. But you can't say what goes on in that room, like how we do it.
Well, you know, I love that because it's kind of like therapy where whatever you say in there, you're free to say anything, you're free to do anything because no one's going to. You know, no one's. It just stays in the room.
Exactly.
I think open mics are like that. No one ever cares.
What happens in Mistakes on Purpose stays in Mistakes on Purpose.
On Purpose. So we love that, and I encourage anybody. I mean, you do small groups, large groups.
Yeah.
Is it good for artists?
Yeah, it's very good for artists.
So, how would you? Because we have a lot of artists here. So, how would you help an artist just so they understand? So we can all understand quickly.
Well, I think the key with, well, for artists or really for anybody, but is a quantity, not quality.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you get away from the idea of doing one good thing, or being inventive or creative, I think like trying to be creative, I always say works about as well as trying to be charming. It just doesn't work. So what you do is you get away from that. You throw that out the window and you just say, we're just going to make a whole bunch of stuff. We're going to do a whole lot of things in a big, big hurry. And I'm going to play disco music and we're going to giggle. And sometimes, you know, we have a drinks party or a dance party after. It's very social. People get together.
Ah.
Some people, I hate the word team building exercise, but you can think of it that way if you want to. I really don't care.
Well,
anything that gets people in the room is a good thing because it does promote silliness and togetherness, and it's super fun and it's totally stress-free because there's no critique. I'm never, you know, saying, oh, that what you did there, that's really good or that's really bad or it works or it doesn't. Basically, it's like inviting people to take part in being like a factory where there's never any comments and you don't really have time to look at what you're doing because it goes so fast.
Right,
so we
right.
use the idea of speed and, you know, carelessness to our advantage because what happens is when you're focused on making one good thing, it's the kiss of death.
Yeah.
But when you make 100 things in a hurry, you'd be amazed that there's some beautiful, beautiful, brilliant results. And I'm not saying you're going to invent something as good as penicillin, which was also a, you know, a mistake on purpose, not on purpose, but Fleming left some dirty dishes in a sink and it became penicillin. But the thing is that if you keep, when you're 20 or 30 and you have, like, let's say you're really good at some digital program, whatever it is, or you're just good at your job, and good at solving problems. That's wonderful. You can make your boss happy, or if you're at school, you can make your teacher happy. You can guarantee a good result, whatever you're working on. But what if you're 30 and 40 and 50 and 60 And you've kept repeating that same winning combination where you can guarantee the results. That's where you get into trouble, because what new thing have you discovered? You need to throw in a curveball. You need something that will disturb the status quo and that pattern. So that's what I do in a workshop. There's nothing wrong with problem solving. I don't want to throw that out the window. But what if you spend one day instead of problem solving where you bring in chaos and randomness and fun and sabotage into your process, whatever it is. So that's all it is.
Yeah,
it's just one day, one afternoon, a few hours to allow people to do that.
Right. It sounds great.
It really does.
And something really helpful. And the way that you have it set up, it really, it's sort of like you put this structure around something that people can just go nuts.
Indeed.
Yeah.
So but it's safe.
And it's safe.
Don't worry.
No.
We haven't had any heart attacks yet.
Well, I mean, I don't know if that's a good thing. No. Okay. I certainly would love to do one sometime. You have to let me know. But I'm going to post about all this stuff in the book. The book is like, what a great gift. Thank you, Lori. Like, this book is not like any other book. I can't even I can't describe it. Okay. You got to see it.
I want to tell you about my favorite chapter in the book.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. There's a chapter called There's a Nipple in My Room, which is about, I was going to do the workshop. It turned out later that this was a super conservative. I knew it was sort of conservative, but they were like right wingers, like the opposite of anything I've ever experienced in, whatchamacallit, where we were, Grand Rapids in Michigan, right in the middle of the country, right? And it was like a consortium of a whole bunch of different businesses to bring up the profile of Grand Rapids as a business location. It was in this big, beautiful hotel, but it was an old hotel. And that's where it was. And I walk into my hotel room in the hotel where the workshop is going to happen. And there's, you know, thousands of people, or a thousand anyway, at this conference. And I walk in and there's a huge picture of a nipple on the wall. I couldn't believe it. And I thought, oh my God, you know, like, Grand Rapids, this hotel, the hotel was a lot more, you know, advanced. But then I looked closer and in the corner it said like tumbleweed, like it was supposed to be a tumbleweed. And there's a picture in the book, maybe you can even post it on the thing, of the nipple. And it's obviously a nipple. But the thing is that even if it was supposed to be a tumbleweed, it was so shocking because if you're used to going to, you know, the Whitney Biennial, which is just the beginning and it's just full of, you know, flagrant sexual, you know, extremely sometimes disturbing and upsetting and controversial images. But in a very conservative town hotel room in this beige, you know, environment, you don't expect to see a big picture of a nibble. So I thought, this is fantastic. So I wrote about it. It's also about, like, you know, like the story of Bluebeard. There's, like, if you know that story, there's one of the three sisters, the youngest one says, wait a minute, there's something wrong with this guy. His beard is blue. And this is before hair dye became popular. You know, this is in the olden days. And the sisters are saying, no, he's rich. He's famous. He's a nobleman. You know, he's okay. But of course he has all these bodies buried in the basement, right? But you have to tell it like it is. Like nobody else is talking about the nipple in the room of the Grand Amway Plaza Hotel. Right. So I nominated it for an art prize, but then it turned out the people that were doing the art prize were the same people. Anyway, it's a long story, but basically that's another point of the book is that you have to say it like notice things and call things out when you see them, you know, and because it's all about context, you know, it's everything. That picture was so much more exciting than anything I've seen in the Whitney Biennial or any modern museum.
But could you see a tumbleweed in it?
You'd have to try. It was such a nipple.
I'm going to check that out.
You should.
So just to bring you listeners up to speed before. Before you listeners got here, I was telling Laurie, this is a very this Laurie's visit, being in the room with Laurie, is very, there's a lot of counter transference. It brings up a lot of feelings for me. So this is going to be a little bit more unusually about me, I think, than most of these shows, because I identify so closely with Lori. I mean, we're same age. We, you know, I studied illustration. She studied illustration. I worked in advertising as an art director for 30 years. Lori had an incredible career. She knows a lot of people that are very, you know, people that I only heard of. She knows them, stuff like that. So I know the business that Lori's involved in. And Lori is somebody that I certainly was in all the books and magazines that me in my job, in my as an art director in an ad agency would be reading about. And I want to use the word envious because I'm afraid of pretending that I'm not envious, and I'm not sure what I really mean by that. But I also want to say admire and respect and in awe. So I am very, very curious to find out how Lori, who seems like somebody who really, I could be wrong about this, but Lori is somebody who really seems like she's followed her own path and doesn't seem to have a lot of self doubt and has really manifested as far as design, advertising, illustration, any of those commercial arts, an ideal career. And I want to find out how she did it. And I guess I'm thinking, what does she have that I don't have? And there's a lot of things in there. Well, she's obviously super, super talented, but also just so natural. And that's what I'm really interested in learning about. And you're okay with that, Lori?
All that? Sure. I'm okay with all of that.
So, first of all, you're incredibly prolific and you've done so well in so many things. So how did you even, like, just to even get into RISD, how did, you know?
I didn't.
Well, what happened?
Well, I didn't get into RISD. I applied to RISD. I went to a really tiny school called Solbury in New Hope, Pennsylvania. It was a boarding school. It was like 250 students. And I was the big art star. So I thought I was God's gift to art. Then I applied to RISD, which in the 70s, this is 73 or 72, whatever.
You're younger than you. So it would have been 73 for you, 74 for me.
When I graduated. I just had my 50th reunion a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
Anyway, so... graduating high school, I applied to a few other schools, but I knew I was going to go to RISD because that was the place.
Absolutely.
Then, more than now, it was, you know, considered the art school. And I didn't get in. I never figured out why, but I was so heartbroken that I went to the school the furthest away, which was CCAC then. Now it's called CCA in Oakland, California College of Art. And I spent a year doing printmaking with Robert Bechtel, who was a great teacher and a great printmaker. And I had a little white dog and a little white Fiat. And I lived in all these weird hippie houses. And then I reapplied to RISD and I got in. I never found out why I didn't or why I did. Mm-hmm. And then I drove across Canada in the year of the Arab oil embargo.
Oh, wow.
And then I went to RISD. But I didn't get in the first time. Uh-huh. And then I also had a very checkered career at RISD because I applied, you know, to go into the graphic design department because I liked type. Mm-hmm. Even though I really didn't know what graphic design was, I always had a thing for lettering and typography. Mm-hmm. And so then I did that, and it was so boring because at that time you could only use Universe and very boring photographs in gray, and there was no color, and it was totally humorless. And I thought, oh no, I've made a big mistake. You know, it was the Swiss style. It was grids and everything. So I said, okay, I better go into illustration work and at least draw. And so I went into illustration, and there they were doing like children's book type stuff that I didn't like. And then I decided I want to go back to graphic design. I'd made a mistake, and they wouldn't let me back unless I took an extra year, and we got in a big fight. Mm-hmm. I got in a fight with the head of the department, so I ended up in painting. And now I always joke that, you know, I'm 67 and I still haven't picked a major. Which I haven't. I do illustration, I do graphic design, I do painting, and I do writing, and I've done some comedy. And for me, it's just all one thing. For other people, it's a problem. But for me, I've always done all of those things. Mm. And since I was born, really, I've always liked to do all those things.
This is what I'm saying. You've done well following your own path. So how are you, how did you grow up? How was creativity a big part in your family? Where did you grow up? Did you have a lot of Did your brothers and sisters, where did you grow up?
Okay, well, I grew up mostly in Manhattan. I was born in Manhattan, but my parents split up when I was three, and then I moved with my mother to Detroit for a few years, which created my taste in music, which is basically Motown still. Then we lived in Connecticut for a couple of years, and the whole time I was begging my mother to go back to New York because nobody understood me in those other places, and I just missed New York. And my father was married four times, and I don't have brothers. I have two half-brothers that are older than me from my father's first marriage, but... and then I have an ex-stepsister who was a singer, Christina, not Christina Aguilera, but just Christina, who made some really interesting records, like Doll in a Box for Z Records in the 80s. But she died a few years ago. But she was a really interesting musician. And then I basically, the way I look at it, I sort of brought myself up. I mean, you know, my mother was a very severe manic depressive. My father was an alcoholic, and he wasn't really around. You know, I would visit him on holidays and stuff. But, and we moved, I went to 16 schools before college.
Wow.
So, because my mother was just finding fault with everything, and we kept moving, because she was crazy.
Wow.
She was really crazy. So, I feel like it was a kind of DIY, do-it-yourself experience, my childhood, because I was, from the beginning, I knew my mother was nuts, and I would have to, like, you know, decide stuff. And
like, can you give us...
I knew that I was going to inherit some money from my grandparents on my father's side, who had money, and... I had, you know, some kind of, you know, trust fund, and I went to them when I was, I think, 12. I went to the right people, and I said, listen, my mother's nuts. She, I can't live with her anymore. I want to go to boarding school.
Oh,
and
wow.
She wanted, she didn't want me to. She wanted to, you know, I mean, she didn't have any money, really, but I knew there was this money that I could maybe access, so I asked permission. And so I did that. I went to that boarding school in Pennsylvania to get away from her.
So impressive.
So I didn't live at home since I was 13.
That's so impressive.
So I had to get away from her.
You.
Yeah. So then I traveled all over Europe alone at 14, and I did a lot of things. When I look about, when I look at it now, it seems pretty advanced. But when I was doing it then, it seemed normal, like I was older than I really was.
Yeah.
Or I felt like it was completely normal.
What is
I've always been very independent.
What did your parents do?
Well, it's a good question. My father was a sculptor. I actually just came back from, I was in Paris teaching this mistakes workshop for ATPI or ITPI. I don't know how you pronounce it, but ATYPI is a really great organization of typography enthusiasts from all over the world. And so I taught the How to Make Mistakes workshop there, and I went to his old studio. My father lived in Paris before my mother, after his first marriage, after the war, there were a lot of GIs, a lot of Americans that stayed in Paris, and among them a lot of artists. And he had a studio at number 8, Rue Saint-Julien-le-Pauvre, and I went there, and I posed in the same pose that he was like leaning up against the wall of the studio. And there's actually going to be a show at the Gray Art Gallery at NYU with a lot of those artists in February 2024.
Wow.
And there's a picture of him in the catalog because he was friends with like David Smith, Shinjiki Tajiri.
Wow.
And there was there was a couple of African American artists that, you know, had much more success in Paris than they would have had in the States. Haywood Bill Rivers and another guy. And there were some, Al Held was one of the, I mean, there were so many people that became famous later that first showed at that studio that he let them use as a gallery.
Wow.
So he was a sculptor and he was a really good sculptor, but he was an even better drunk and he didn't really ever make a name for himself as a sculptor because he was, you know, wine, women and song, basically.
And his family, he he had some support.
Yes.
So that,
he had money in his family.
Yeah,
so that made it possible for him to not, you know, sell or be, you know, successful.
What did his parents, did he come from an overachieving family? A lot of pressure?
No. Okay. I wouldn't put it that way. But like I said, it was really my great grandfather that had made money, and mm-hmm. that, you know, he inherited.
Yeah.
He was able to get away with it, not making a living. And my mother had, you know, when they divorced, a settlement, which wasn't very good from him, you know, and we lived very modestly, me and my mother. But, you know, I think that coming from my father's family and the attitudes about money really did help me not be afraid. I wasn't really thinking about making a living ever. I mean, I did make a living, but I never made a lot of money. I never made what would be considered good money, especially in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't have been able to, you know, live the way that I did because I had some money left and I bought a loft in 1981.
Mm-hmm.
When it cost like $100,000.
Yeah, right.
You know? And so that very one thing made it possible for me to live much better than I normally would have under other circumstances, you know, because illustration has never paid well. I mean, that's not true. I think it did in the 50s or the 40s. No, really.
Yeah, I think you're right.
You had like the Saturday Evening Post.
Right,
and
right.
Paul Rand would be chatting with the head of Cummings, you know, and or whatever.
Fashion illustration. Yeah, I was in love with fashion illustration.
Yeah, and everything was... So I would say, but now it's really bad because those magazines don't exist anymore, of course. But, I mean, I made doing both work for Condé Nast as a editorial designer.
Yeah.
I worked for GQ. I worked briefly for Allure. I worked for Mademoiselle in the 80s, which was really fun, doing layouts, you know, and I worked at the New York Times Magazine was my very first job.
Wow.
The first thing I did was color in the squares of the Sunday crossword. With rubylith. Do you know what rubylith is?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I do.
It's cutting out little red, you know, like film to color in the black squares. So I learned on the job.
Pre-computer, guys. You don't know anything about this.
Yeah.
those are all like really, like, I mean, I think about like, say we were, you know, I was like whatever, working as an assistant in a design, very lowly job in a design studio at the same time. And like to me, what you were doing took so much talent. Like you had to have a really high level of quality in your work to be able to do it. Like how did you feel? Like I can't even imagine getting hired in a situation like that.
Well, I lied my way in there. I absolutely lied. I went in with my portfolio to the New York Times Magazine. At that time, the art director was Ruth Ansell. And I went in, and there was a guy, Charlie Churchward, who later was an art director at Vogue. And he looked at my portfolio of illustrations. And I think I must have seemed like a crazy person because I had these illustrations that were 30 by 40 inches, white ink on black paper. And everybody knows that illustrations are like 2 inches black on white.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just insane. But I said, oh, by the way, I can also do mechanicals. And not only could I not do mechanicals, but I didn't know what they were.
Mm.
Somebody told me it was a good way to make money.
Mm-hmm.
So I lied. And then he left a message on my answering machine, which was a cassette in those days. And said, can you come in on Monday? We need somebody to do mechanicals at the magazine. And I freaked out because I didn't know what it was. And I got a book called Production for the Graphic Designer. I read it cover to cover, didn't understand a word, showed up on Monday. There was a proportion wheel on my desk. I looked at it. I asked some guy next to me, I said, what's this? And it was obvious I didn't know anything because that was the main tool you used to size like we would have photostats
of
all the photographs that were going in the layouts. So you'd say it needs to be 88% or 20%.
These guys aren't getting any of that.
So, no, but this was before computers.
Yeah, right. It was complicated. You had to know shit.
How you laid out
a
magazine.
Exactly.
So I learned on that job everything.
And did they know you didn't know anything?
Well, it became obvious right away.
And they taught you?
Well, not on purpose. They just liked me, I guess.
Yeah, because see, I had a very parallel where I got a job, like I would lie too about doing mechanicals. But I like would always be so nervous when I got there. I just exuded insecurity, like I didn't know what I was doing, and I couldn't get rid. I couldn't control it. So the shit never, you know. I mean, it was really hard. But like, so what would it if I'd been like? Were you comfortable? Did you think it was going to be okay? Like, what would it have been like? Well, you didn't. But also, I know I'm interrupting myself and you, and I'm sorry about that. Excuse me. But so what I'm also imagining, though, from your childhood is that I'm picturing somebody who, I mean, is just incredibly self-sufficient and never was really questioned. Like you, it sounds like you had to take charge as a child growing up of you and your mother, your family. Is that right?
I would say in a certain way. I mean, she wasn't incapable of taking care of me. I don't mm-hmm. want to sound like
no,
that.
No, but
she made sure that I was clothed and fed and,
yeah.
you know, I was never, you know, out on the street. There was not remotely.
No, there was
but she was just crazy. So she was crying all the time and, you know, threatening to kill herself and all that stuff. So that was, you know, what gave me the, it was a necessity that I also relied on other people. Like, for instance, I had a boyfriend when I was really young that had a wonderful set of parents, especially his mother, who was a painter. And I sort of moved into their apartment. I remember working in their building as an elevator operator during an elevator strike because there were a lot of doctors on the building on East 86th Street. And I glommed on to the right people. I think I may be talented as an artist or whatever, but I think by far my biggest talent is for making friends and to, because I didn't have brothers or sisters.
Right.
I didn't really have the kind of family you could rely on.
Right.
When I was growing up, I was really close with my dogs. I always had a dog. I insisted on having a dog. But I really needed, like, other people around me that I could trust. And I found them, you know, in different ways. I found really good friends, and I'm really good at keeping friends. And it's very, 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 very important to me. Like, you know, maybe too important to me, but that's it. I don't have, right, you know, I don't have a partner. I don't have children. I have friends, you know, and I'm very, very lucky that I have some good ones because I really needed other people to help me.
Well, I mean, it also sounds like you must be a really trustworthy person that you were able to form trusting relationships. But
I love shoplifting.
Well, that's not about trust. Are you a compulsive shoplifter?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a skill. That's like a compulsion and a skill.
I really like getting away with it.
Have you been in therapy? I haven't asked you that.
Yeah, a long time ago, I was in therapy for years, and then I realized that it didn't. I knew all along it didn't work. My parents put me in therapy because they knew that they were screwing me up. But out of their guilt, they. I remember there was like a therapist who had like foam rubber animals that would like jump out. I was like two, you know. And then I wrote in my book, I wrote this book called All the Wrong People Have Self-Esteem. And it was supposed to be for teenage girls, but I really think it's for anybody who thinks it's funny. And in this book, I tell this story about, you know, these different therapists that I've had and stuff. And one of them, well, there's one story that I was walking by this building where our best friends, my best friend, her family lived, and her mother used to give these fabulous brunches. And this was when she was still alive in the early 90s or something on the Upper West Side where I grew up. And so they still lived there, right? So I walked by our old building, which is 350 Central Park West on 95th Street and Central Park.
Nice.
And we had the penthouse apartment. So I asked the doorman, who lives in the penthouse? And he said, well, which one? And then the last time I'd been there, I was three. You know, when I was asking the question, I was like 40. So I said, well, it faced the park and downtown, because I remember the windows, right? And he said, oh, that's Dr. Liefer. So I go home and I write a postcard. Dear Dr. Liefer, I was a baby in your apartment. Could I go look for a minute? And anyway, to make a long story short, I ended up going there, and I walk into my bedroom, and where my crib was the psychiatric couch.
Oh my God. I
know.
I
couldn't believe it. And then I thought, oh my God, I've got to get shrunk here. Because they were both shrinks, and they'd bought the apartment furnished from my parents in 1958.
That's so crazy.
And they never, I don't think they ever redecorated. So I did go there and get shrunk there.
So you went there just because?
Yes. And I lied down in the same place that I'd laid down when I was an infant.
So you weren't even like, I want therapy. You were like,
No. Well, that was, that might have been the last time I ever did go to therapy.
So you don't find therapy useful?
No, I take the drugs.
And you're on antidepressants.
Well, yeah, an anti-anxiety. It's sort of a little bit of both.
Yeah, I'm on drugs too.
So, yeah, I mean, always going to be. I have no problem with it. I mean, to me, there's obviously some kind of chemical something that these medicines help me with, but I'm totally fine with that.
Yeah, I mean, they don't know how they work, but they do work. They have studies.
Yeah, I don't want to stop them.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's good.
No, I mean, it's fine with me. I think it's been very helpful.
I do too.
But the talk therapy for me was never
just
working.
Didn't work.
No.
So, I'm also thinking that when you said you lived in you went to 18 different schools.
16.
Well, that's a detail.
Why quibble?
So that must have made you really agile at making friends, or like, how do you remember that? Do you remember that as changing schools as normal? Did you have trouble making friends?
I got very good at making friends and also very good at letting them go, you know, mm-hmm. But then some of them I kept, you know, my friend Gina, who's one of my closest friends, maybe, you know, I have like two or three. She's one of the two or three, tippy top. She was my best friend growing up, and we've known each other since birth. She was her mother that had those parties, you know,
We
were friends of my parents. So we've always known each other. And that's very important to me to have that sort of history. And other friends that, you know, I went to high school with or whatever, or that I met from RISD, and I have all these friends in Sweden. You know, I've been living there on and off for many years.
Oh,
so
okay.
I have different sort of collections of friends that usually don't know each other. But
and what about what happened when, I mean, part of that time you were, you went to boarding school when you were 12?
13.
13 mm-hmm. to 18? Or
yeah.
And so there was consistency there, right?
Well, yeah, it was such a small, it was great, this reunion I just went to, but there was a lot of bluegrass music, you know, guys with gray ponytails playing, you know, fiddles and banjos stuff, but in the countryside. But it was great, you know, we were really close, and I think, you know, there's something about the kind of friendships you make when you're that age, when you're a teenager, that are so intense and so close, you know, that have a kind of meaning for me. And also I felt like that school and going away from my crazy mother saved me. You know, I was so lucky that I could do that.
No, it's impressive that self-preservation instinct.
Definitely.
And knowing
that's also true of, you know, when I was in Walden, I, you know, there were people that were like, I loved Walden was also a really super progressive school in the city that I went to before then. You know, there were people overdosing and stuff, but I never really got into drugs or anything mm-hmm. because I saw that, you know, it was beyond just say no,
I saw
it with my own eyes.
Right.
And so I think that self-preservation thing really kicked in.
Yeah. Yeah. And what about like, so I'm curious about, so working in these commercial creative fields, I always had so much self-doubt. And whenever I was like showing people the ads that I was, you know, making, or the, you know, my boss, the creative directors, the products, whatever I was making, I was all, no matter who it was and no matter what the work was, I was always terrified. Like that I was always afraid that it wasn't very good and I was going to get shot down. So you were in a lot of very difficult or very intense situations with your own work, which was even more personal to you. So how did you feel about showing your work? Did you have self-doubt, or were you just like nonplussed about it?
Well, it depends which thing you're talking about. On a creative level, on a visual level, on a design level, I've always felt that my work is really, really good. And I also knew that it was sometimes kind of innovative and different.
Mm-hmm.
So I got half or maybe more than half my illustrations killed. I used to call myself the queen of the Kilfies, or Rosenworld, the little house that Kilfies built. It's like a joke, but it was really true, because mm-hmm. like I could never sketch because I don't like repeating myself. So what I would do, and still do actually when this happens, is where the client says, you know, draw a bowl of fruit or whatever. So, okay, well, I'll draw it, and what I'm going to give you a finish. If you like it, it's a finish. And if you don't like it, it's a sketch. Because I didn't want to do like the normal process right. and what illustrators spend all their time doing. And it's the most illustrator thing in the world is to do sketches and sketches. And then you do a comp and then a finish and then change it. That's normal. But I would say, you know, I'm going to do a finished thing. And then if you don't like it, we'll call it a sketch and I'll do it over. So what would happen is, like, most of the time they would say, no, we don't like it. And I would have to do it over and over and over. And sometimes for the New Yorker, which was my favorite client, I literally did things over 100 times. It became like a complete psychosis. But I could never do like a rough sketch. This is what it's going mm-hmm. to look like, because then I'd have to repeat myself. And so when I work, I like to make things up as I go along. And I don't want to have to be true to that thing that I showed the client. It's like I'm allergic to that, and I still am. So it's a really stupid way of working. Well, it's not at all practical, but it was more fun for me. And that's what I was after, is that I wanted each job to be, because I always think like an artist or a painter, not like an illustrator. And, you know, I know I have to communicate something, and I want to, and I hate the kind of design or illustration that doesn't communicate. So I'm very traditional in that sense, but I want to experiment with the formal qualities, the line and the color and the shapes and how they fit together. I want to discover it as I go along. Mm-hmm. I don't want to make a promise and then have to keep it. You
right.
know what I mean?
Absolutely.
That well, takes away the fun for
it,
me.
It sounds like you kind of established a situation which where you really had the authority, where you were really in control, because as you said, and I know this well, as because I, as an art director, I would hire illustrators, you know, and have to have the work approved by my creative director client. I went through that. I know that. And what you did is very unusual in the way that you set that situation up. So if anyone was hiring you, they were going to have to play by your rules in a way.
Right, except it didn't really work. I don't want to make it sound like I was this big success story. I wasn't. I was successful on a creative level, but on a business level, it was a disaster, because, like I said, I get half the stuff killed that never saw the light of day, and I would get a kill fee. So instead of a big $100, I'd get 50 or whatever. I mean, that happened more than it didn't happen.
But you got
so
hired? You had people that would hire you regularly?
Yeah, they must have been nuts.
Oh, see? See, this is what... No, but you had people... So whoever you worked with appreciated you for exactly what you did.
Right.
And they were... And you probably had good relationships with...
I did. I think I had good relationships, especially at the New Yorker for a long time. And I miss working for the New Yorker. I loved working for them, even though I had to do things over hundreds of times sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I respect the magazine.
Sure,
I love
course.
The magazine. I was reading it since I was little. You know?
That's a big thing.
But, you know, I was doing stuff. There's this magazine called American Bystander that would let me write, you know, like their version of Shouts and Murmurs, like a humor mm-hmm. piece, and then give me a whole page to illustrate it. And that's
wow.
fun.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you should check out American Bystander. They have like a... It's a, you know, former National Lampoon people and stuff from
oh, wow.
LA. Yeah,
oh,
but
wow.
they really have great illustrators that work for, you know,
right.
good people
right.
and cartoonists and stuff. So that's my favorite thing, is when I can write something, hopefully a funny thing, and then illustrate it too. So that's what I do in my books, and that's what I did with, you know, Mistakes mm-hmm. on Purpose books. And this other book, Memoir, which is spelled M-E-M-W-A-H, that I'm working on now, that I still haven't gotten the right publisher for, but I will. It's an illustrated memoir and hopefully funny, but you know, it's how can I put this? I always fall sort of between the cracks of stuff. Like it's not a graphic novel. Mm-hmm. It's an illustrated mm-hmm. memoir. Mm-hmm. You know, it's illustrated. So it doesn't, but I don't think in boxes. So right.
Like I said, it's like the book I was just looking at. Hard to describe.
It's very hard to describe. Right.
Look it up.
That's my specialty.
Do your research, guys. I'm going to post. I'll make it easy for you. All right.
Okay. Jesus. Yeah. Anyway, so.
So one of my biggest fears was being homeless, seriously. Like, I mean, you know, I had parents, they didn't have a lot of money. They were very like, you know, you got to get a job. You got to get a job with health insurance. You got to have that paycheck. And so I was always really worried about being able to earn a living. And that had a big effect on my career and my self-esteem and everything else because I got fired a lot because I was so afraid of getting fired. But anyway, back to the interview. So you sound like you had a very different take on money. Not that you had a lot of it, but you weren't really worried about it. You were going to make enough money somehow or other.
Well, like I said, it made a huge difference in my life that I bought this loft in 1981. And because of that, I knew I wouldn't be homeless. I knew I wouldn't mm-hmm. be out on the street. I owned it myself at a very young age, and that changed everything for me.
But you must have had to make, you know, payments on it or food.
Yeah, of course. And I did make a living, you know, like I said, doing illustration and mostly working at magazines, like, you know, and at the New York Times Magazine and at Mademoiselle and all the. Yeah, I worked really hard and I made money, but I didn't make great money. And I think mm-hmm. now that I'm doing more painting, I'm kind of on another track and I sell paintings, but I don't, you know, I guess it's pretty insane to think that you'll ever make money with books. Yeah. I mean, my last book
or paintings.
The Mistakes on Purpose book is published by Hachette, which is a big publisher.
Good.
But that doesn't guarantee, you know, books in general
don't make a lot of money. We all know.
You know,
I'm
not Stephen King.
Right.
So
right.
So
right.
But you figure, you know, I'm 67, right? So if I'm lucky, I have another 10 or 20 years. What am I going to do? Am I going to make stuff or not make stuff? Mm-hmm. Those are the two questions.
Right.
So I don't really think about, you know, maybe I should worry more, but I wake up every day and I either paint or write. You know, I go to the library to write and I have a studio in Jersey City and then I go and paint. And I paint in an encaustic, which is, you know, melted beeswax. Mm. And because I wanted to paint really, really thick, opaque. Mm-hmm. You know, I really love that's what I want to spend my time mm-hmm. doing mm-hmm. is making stuff. And then I still am writing and I'm mm-hmm. working on, you know, endless revisions mm-hmm. to memoir. Mm-hmm. And, you know, every day I wake up and I make stuff because that's my MO.
I guess having that apartment though gave you a little, well, there's a feeling of security just from that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'm very, very lucky. Yeah. And I know I'm lucky.
But also, you're so prolific. So I was wondering about your work habits. Are you like a workaholic? How have you done so much? Have you created so many different things? Are you like,
said they were good.
Oh,
just
stop.
A lot of things. No, really.
Well, you must be, I mean, you have created a lot of things. I mean, have you had people working for you?
Oh, periodically, I've had different assistants. I had one assistant, then I realized she was making more money than me, and I thought, this doesn't look right. You know, so... No.
And but are you working all the time? Like,
yeah.
Are you really driven?
I never would say driven. I watch a lot of TV, a lot of good TV. I'm not driven. I like to read, you know, I listen to audiobooks now all the time. And I have a little car and I drive everywhere. And I do, you know, I mix it up. It's like about half the time I go up to this secret library and I go and they have a writer's room on the top floor and I go there and I write. And then the other days I drive through the Holland Tunnel to Jersey City and I paint all day. and then I go home. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm either doing one or the other. Mm-hmm. And once in a while, I'll do a design job or an illustration job, but mostly I'm spending my time either writing, working on books, and mm-hmm. painting. And doing workshops. I do workshops like the one I'm going to in Vancouver on the 30th and 31st of May this month. So I go and do that a few times a year. And I really want to find, you know, better venues to do, like bigger, better, interesting venues to do the workshops. Mm. That's what I'm really bad at. I mean, I did have an assistant last year that was trying to help me, you know, book better places for the workshops, but it's very hard to know who to write to, because there's places that do still have like corporate offsites and things like that. Mm-hmm. But people are, you know, they want to know what are they getting for their money.
Right.
You know, I don't blame them.
Right.
And things, belts are really tight and stuff. But I think that it's important, especially now, you know, to have bring people in a company together and it's fun and stuff. So I need to let people know that, but it's hard to know how, because, you know, I'm never going to have thousands and zillions of followers. I mean, I have Instagram, I have all that stuff, but, you know, it's very hard to, you know, be noticed unless you have 100,000 followers. And most of the people that are successful, like an illustrator, you know, they have that if they're 30 and they're not 67, because they grew up with it and they enjoy it.
The work also has to be translate well on Instagram. I mean, I think, you know, I've seen that with a lot of painters who do really beautiful work, and if it doesn't read on Instagram, it can be the best work in the world, which is a terrible criteria to be evaluating work on, but it really does matter. So I'm also I'm imagining you have a pretty active social life. I bet you have a ton of friends, right? I see you as somebody who's out with your friends, socializing.
I mean,
I get invited places. We're having a party.
No. Nobody's having parties.
No one has parties.
Who's having parties?
I don't know anyone, really.
No, I mean, I used to have a lot of parties I had the
loft. You must have had some great parties.
I had fabulous parties. Now, you know, I had a dinner with two friends last night. Is that a party? I don't think so. I mean, it's not like I'm going to nightclubs, you know.
No, I hope not. Who wants to do that?
I actually would love to do that if I could find the right one. But anyway.
House of Yes, right here.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Okay, we'll go.
Okay. I like that. I like that idea. I'm a club kid.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah.
You have an active social life. That's part of, we're talking of the whole picture.
I really don't.
No?
No.
No?
No, I think that, you know, people on social media, you know, texting each other and stuff has replaced a lot of in-person stuff.
You're right about that.
And I don't like it one bit. I'm not good at texting. For me, it's sort of like I want to see people in person. And I think even before the pandemic, that really went sort of south. So I'm regretting that.
I know. I think we all do. So we only have a minute left. I want to remind everybody, I want to thank you. Thank you, Laurie Rosenwald. Please go to rosenworld.com. Check out her book, How to Make Mistakes on Purpose. And make sure you look up her seminars and her TED Talk. And thank you for listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. Dr. Lisa gives a shit every Thursday, 2 to 3. Have a great afternoon, all right? We'll see you next week.
Thanks, Lisa.
Okay, so now we have 20 seconds. I could sing. But, okay, why don't you go to my Instagram, all right? Dr. Dr. Lisa Levy SP. Do that, okay? Or check me out. Send me an email anytime. drlisa@radiofreebrooklyn.org if you got something you want to. Dr. Lisa gives a shit.